The first place I ever lived in on my own was a two-bedroom flat in England, and I guarantee you whatever you're picturing in your head is a lot nicer than what it was. I was sitting on the second floor of a building over a liquor store, and the only access to my place was a spiral staircase, which led to the back alley behind the store. I was constantly plagued by drunken patrons gathering at the base of my stairs, loudly barking at each other and pissing into the gutter. Occasionally they would sit on the bottom of the steps, and the staircase squeaked so loudly when any pressure was applied to it that it would sometimes wake me up as I was trying to drift off to sleep. Once or twice, I would have some drunkards climb the staircase and peer inside the window by my front door. I'm not sure why. Maybe they thought there was a second liquor store up there or something. One night, I arrived home at 11 p.m. on a rainy evening and propped open the door for a few minutes before settling in. I had a cat named Ozzy who I would let out during the day and go scrounge around in the alleyway and bully other stray cats. Normally at night, Ozzy would prefer to come up the steps and slip into the flat and spend the evening with me. Then the following morning, I would feed him and let him out again. He would normally get pretty anxious being cooped up inside all day and start to paw around the door. So there was never really a question of trying to reprogram him into a strictly indoor cat. Sure enough, a few minutes later after I kicked my shoes off, I could hear Ozzy's soft pattering of feet climbing up the shaky metal staircase. Once the cat was inside, I shut and locked the door and set the food out for my furry flatmate. Afterwards, I made myself dinner, washed up, and went to bed. All the while, Ozzy reclined on the chair across the room, silently judging me. I went to emphasize that I wasn't under the influence of alcohol or drugs, prescribed or otherwise, when I went to sleep. At 3 a.m., I was awoken to Ozzy hissing loudly, and I rolled over to turn the light on. Part of the reason I kept Ozzy around was that he was a very quiet cat. Sure, he would let me know when he was hungry, but I had never heard him make a noise like this before. His hissing sent chills down my spine, and as he stood by the front door, he hissed twice more, before darting across the room to hide under the couch. I couldn't hear anything from outside, aside from the soft patter of rain, and I figured the cat had to be crazy. Because if there had been anyone or anything on the staircase, I would have heard the squeaking of the rusty metal. I laid there and listened for another few moments, before reaching over to turn off the light and go back to bed. Right as my fingers grazed the switch, the cat hissed angrily once again, and there came a sharp slap on the outside of the front door. Not a knock, but rather a sound as though someone had just taken their hand and smacked it on the door. I leapt up and grabbed a knife from the cutting board, as my kitchen counter was directly outside my bedroom door. I stomped over, making sure my footsteps were loud, and I made to turn on the light outside. There was a brief flash, and darkness immediately followed. The light outside had burnt out. I don't really watch horror movies. I'm prone to anxiety and become agitated very easily. All I could think as my heart jumped into my throat and my blood ran cold was, "Is this what happens in horror movies?" I wrenched open the door with the knife up, prepared to face a drunken moron who thought all this was funny, knowing that what I was doing was both the bravest and dumbest thing I've ever done. The wind and the rain hit my face, and the cold encircled me like an unwanted hug. But there was no one there. At least, that's what I thought. Had the light been on, I might have seen it before I took a step outside. As it was, the only light I had was from my lamp behind me. I took one cautious step outside, and felt the cold metal under my bare foot. I then looked down. A pale-faced woman with jet-black eyes, her hands outstretched before her, her head tilted upward, staring directly up at me. She could have been anywhere from 15 to 20, I suppose, but honestly, I did not pause to take a second look. Her hand wrapped itself around my ankle in a surprisingly strong grip, and I nearly kicked her in the face as I freed my foot. I saw the raindrops strike her wide-open eyes without causing her to blink as I slammed the door in her face. Right before I locked it, I heard her hiss from outside, "I'm coming in." That's legitimately the last thing I remember. I may have fainted, I'm not sure. I woke up again at 7, all wrapped up in my bed, and my first thought was, "Oh, thank God. It was all just a dream." I had no recollection of returning to bed, or turning off the lights, so it had to have been all in my head. I got up and immediately walked over to the front door, unlocked it, and opened it up. I discovered the kitchen knife lying there on the welcome mat. There was no girl, no blood, or any other sign that someone had been there. I picked up the knife and examined the outside of the door. No damage of any kind. I told myself that I had been sleepwalking or something, and was honestly ready to leave it at that, but Ozzy would not come out from under the couch. It took me a full day and a half to coax him out, even with food, but after that finally worked, I couldn't get him to leave the apartment. Whenever I held the door open for him, he would hiss and refuse to move towards it. After another day, I picked him up, put him in a box, and carried him down the stairs. Once at the bottom, he shot off like a rocket. Later that night, he returned, but refused to climb back up the stairs. Whatever happened that night, whatever I saw, it wasn't just in my head. I've lied awake at night trying to figure out if that girl was a real person, maybe either on drugs or wounded and needed my help. But even if that were the case, why would she climb a spiral staircase to seek help instead of knocking at the dozen or so other doors at the ground level? And why hadn't I heard her climbing the stairs? Please don't dismiss this as just another creepy story. I would really like to hear some opinions. Does this qualify as a haunting? Give me some feedback so I can put my mind at ease. When I was a child, I lived in Cuba with my grandparents. Between the ages of 3 and 5, I was told I was very imaginative. I would say very random and unsettling things that didn't make any sense. Most of the time, they were shrugged off by everyone, but occasionally something I said in the past would be recalled with sharp clarity later in my life. For example, one time I was sitting under a tree while my grandmother tended to her garden during the late spring. I leapt up and ran over to her suddenly in a wild panic, clutching my forearm and crying that my arm was broken. My grandmother gave me a perplexed look and asked how I had done that when I was just sitting there. I would continue to whine that I was hurt. She felt my arm, and despite me not reacting to any pain, I still insisted that it was broken. My grandmother assured me that I was fine. I only vaguely recall the incident, but I trust my grandmother's memory. Several years later, I was sitting on a branch high up in the same tree, reading a book when my cousin hurled a dodgeball at me. It struck me in the back of the head. The blow didn't hurt me, but it did cause me to lose my balance, and I fell out of the tree and landed awkwardly on my arm. Clutching my arm, I ran over to my grandmother as she was gardening and stated through gritted teeth that my arm was broken. My grandmother paused before answering me, and in that moment, I could tell by the look in her eyes, she was recalling when I had complained about my arm a few years before. Just like the first time, it was late spring, the same time of day, and even the weather was similar. My grandmother reminded me of it in the hospital after my arm was bandaged. I didn't know what to say. Later that year, something similar happened. While I was playing out by the pier, my arm still in its cast, I fell into the water and started thrashing awkwardly, unable to swim very well because of the pain in my arm. My grandfather dove in and pulled me out. My grandmother's face went white, and she later told me several years earlier she had taken me out to that same pier, and when I walked out to the edge I started coughing and hacking, and started telling her that I couldn't swim very well because my arm was sore. I couldn't recall that happening, but my grandmother looked so worried and stunned that she sat down on a bench and started praying out loud. She looked far too frightened to me to be making this all up. Again, she claimed that that happened around the same time of year. There was a few more times over the next year when I would hurt myself or nearly have an accident, and my grandmother would get that fearful look in her eye, as though recalling a memory. But I didn't interrogate her. I didn't think it was right making her explain it to me when she was so alarmed. Once I was bitten by a dog on my hand, and my grandmother exclaimed that I had told her about a scar that I would have one day just below my wrist. She took me to the chapel and had a priest bless me with holy water. Before my grandmother died, she wrote down a list of potential accidents that may occur to me based on memories, and left it with my mom. The following New Year's Day, We were sitting around the dinner table when my mom got a call from a friend. It was horrific. My old babysitter Stephanie had been found dead. Her body was charred black after being set on fire. My mother's jaw hit the floor, and she went and found my grandmother's note. "Do you remember why Stephanie stopped babysitting you?" my mother asked me. I told her I didn't. "It was because you scared her. You told her that one day Ricky was going to burn her." Ricky was the name of Stephanie's ex-boyfriend. I had told her that at a New Year's party in front of my grandmother. We debated calling the police, unsure of whether or not it was even worth it. But later that same day, my mother got a call back saying that Ricky had confessed to the crime and was now in police custody. A week later, I burned the note. There was at least a half page more that my grandmother had written about, but I didn't want to know. It just scares me. So after a decade of burying this story inside me, trying night after night not to let it bother me, I've decided to share it. Not because I think other people will enjoy hearing it, but because I need to hear someone else's take on it and try to view what happened from a different perspective. In the late fall of 2009, I was driving my friends home after a night of beer and bowling. I was a designated driver, and I was as sober as a surgeon. We were taking back roads to avoid the road work on the highways, and driving through mostly small residential areas and wide open patches of farmland. Less than a mile away from the first stop, where I would be dropping off one of my friends, I spotted something on the side of the road. I applied the brakes and slowed down. There in the pitch darkness was a kid. A young boy just wandering down the road all by himself, maybe about 7 or 8 years old. I pulled off to the side of the road and quickly got out and walked over to him. He paused when he saw me coming and just nervously stared at me like a kitten would look at you from a cage in a pet store. It was evident that he had been crying. I told him my name and asked him if he was all right, why he was out here and where he was going. He was wearing a red polo shirt that was about 2 sizes too large, green shorts and flip-flops, and was probably very cold, though he was doing a great job of not showing it. After hesitating a few heartbeats, he said his name was Emmanuel, and he had run away from home and had gotten lost and couldn't find his way back. He spoke in a kind of shaky monotone whisper, like he was worried that he would say something wrong and I would abandon him on the side of the road. I asked where he lived, and he gave me an address right away. I pulled out my cell phone and asked for his parents' number so I could call them, and he claimed that he couldn't remember it. At this time, from behind me, my rowdy drunken friends were being obnoxious and loud, and calling out questions to me from back in the car, like what the kid's deal was and how long we would be parked there. My buddy in the front seat got out of the car to take a piss in the weeds. I told Emmanuel that I would take him home, and reached out to take his hand. But he walked right past me instead towards the car. I let him climb into the now vacant passenger seat, and I told my drunken friend who got out of the car to climb into the hatchback. I closed the passenger door once the kid was inside. He didn't put on a seatbelt, but I didn't force him to. I didn't want to make him feel like I was abducting him or tying him down. I just wanted him to remain calm. I put the car into drive and pulled back out into the street, going exactly the speed limit. All of my intoxicated friends were awkwardly introducing themselves from the back seat, but the boy just stared ahead, his eyes never leaving the dashboard in front of him. I noticed after a few moments he started crying again. I couldn't tell if they were tears of pain, shame, or fear. "Are you all right?" I asked him again. He nodded and let out a tiny hiccup. I told him that there was some fast food napkins under the seat, and he reached down and used them to wipe out his eyes. I considered calling the cops, but one of my drunken friends was underage, and had the feeling that the police would be more interested in them than the kid. So I decided to drop off my 2 friends first, just so the kid felt less overwhelmed, and then I would make a detour to where the kid said his house was. After another 10 minutes, I had dropped off 2 of my 3 friends, and the last one had fallen asleep in the back seat. I left the residential side streets and got back onto the main roads. I drove for a few minutes before finding the street I wanted. I asked the kid how long he had been walking, and he just shrugged and replied, a long time. As I was driving up the street, I kicked myself for not offering him food or water. I didn't have any in the car, but I could have stopped somewhere or found something on the way. I pulled into the cul-de-sac and drove to the very last house. It was kind of tucked away behind some trees. I pulled into the driveway, but before I could even park the car, the kid opened the door and hopped out.
"Thanks,"
he called out. And I remember thinking that his voice sounded so much more cheerful and calm than it had before. He ran towards the house, where there was absolutely no lights on, and he waved to me once he got to the front porch. I leaned over to pull the passenger door shut, and was surprised to find the handle was icy cold to the touch. Not so cold that it was unpleasant, just very chilled, like I had spent a few minutes in a freezer. When I looked back up, Emmanuel was gone. I hadn't heard the door open or shut. No lights had come on inside the house either. I waited for another half minute, but my friend snoring in the back reminded me that I needed to get him home. After I dropped my last passenger off, I parked my car and decided to call the police, just to perform a welfare check on the kid. I gave the operator the address, and after a moment, she informed me that no one was listed as living there. Confused, I told her what had happened, and asked her to have a couple of patrol cars meet me there, afraid that the kid may have just been squatting there, and had no intention of returning to his actual home. It was past 2 a.m. when I pulled into that driveway again. Two police cars were already there waiting for me. They said they had swept the entire property and checked the inside of the house, but there was no one there. Apparently, the year before, there had been a terrible fire in the kitchen that destroyed most of the ground floor and half of the second floor above it. The house was uninhabitable, and the current owners were in a battle with the insurance company over what to do with it. I told them about the boy, and they responded that if he had been there, he was long gone now. A few days later, I contacted a PI friend of mine, and she informed me that several years prior to the fire, another family had lived in that house, who had lost a son in a freak accident. He had been killed while riding his bike on the side of the road. The spot where he died was the exact spot where I had found Emmanuel. My friend told me the boy's name was Charlie, but admitted that his middle initial had been listed as E. I felt like I had swallowed wet cement, because my insides were heavy and my head was spinning. I refused to believe that I encountered anything paranormal. The boy had been solid, made of flesh and bone. But even as I told myself that, I remembered that I had never actually touched him. A couple of weeks later, I drove by the same spot where I found him, just to get a look at the place in daylight. After idling in my car for a few moments, I drove off. I hadn't made it 15 feet when I caught a glimpse of a boy in a red polo shirt in my rearview mirror. I slammed on the brakes so hard I skidded, and I leapt from the car to look around. There was nothing there. My friends from that night were no help. They could barely remember the ride home, as they had all been drunk or asleep. Just the thought of retelling this to my friends and loved ones worries me. I don't want them looking at me like I'm crazy, but there have been so many nights that I have stared up at the ceiling in the dark, wondering if that boy was really a lost soul, and upon returning him home, he was unable to find his family. For those of you who believe or want to believe in these things, what do you think? What can I do so I'll be able to sleep peacefully at night again?
There's always a reason to be afraid.